Welcome to the Tablet Podcast, The Whys and the Wherefores. We're looking at the question of truth and whether it still matters. And this week, the topic is why, oh why, Aquinas? And Ben McCoy and I are going to be looking at how reason and revelation, as argued by St. Thomas Aquinas from foundations laid by Aristotle, can help us cope with the relativism of today. Last week, Father Alban, Catholic priest, philosopher and theologian, helped unpick something of the story of Socrates and Plato, as we grappled with that important question of does truth still matter? We will return to these two core philosophers in future episodes and address in more detail how their work can shed light on the ever-topical question of truth in our modern era. But today, just to set a little more philosophical and theological context to our discussions, we're going to look a little bit at St. Thomas Aquinas, the massively influential 13th century Italian Dominican. He was himself hugely influenced by Aristotle. And this ties in nicely with our first episode because, of course, Socrates was the teacher of Plato, and Plato the teacher of Aristotle. Interestingly, Aristotle actually tutored Alexander the Great, the only general said never to have lost a battle. Aristotle lived in the 4th century before the Christian era. Aquinas lived nearly a millennium or so later, in the 13th century of our own Christian era. So, Alban, just to start us off, how did Aristotle come to be tutored by Plato? Did the direction of philosophy that we saw last week, culminating in the murder by hemlock of Socrates, change under the influence of Aristotle? And how come it took so long for someone like Aquinas to pick it up and run with it? What was it that Aquinas did with the teachings of Aristotle that was so significant? And why is it all regarded as still so relevant? Why does it still matter unto this very day?
Well, the answer to your question, did the course of philosophy change with Aristotle, is a most resounding and definite yes. You remember that Aristotle joined Plato's philosophical school in Athens, the Academy, as a young man of 17. And he stayed at the Academy for, I think, something like 20 years until Plato died. Aristotle himself left Athens for political reasons, but eventually returned and set up his own school, the Lyceum. And it was there that he developed and in many ways grew away from Platonic thought. So perhaps I should just say the way in which, in a very basic way anyway, he grew away from Plato. You remember we were talking last week about Plato and the question of truth. And I think it's fair to say that for Plato, the reality of the world and its ultimate structure is located not in the world that we see and perceive through our senses, but in a world that transcends this world, and a world rooted in what he called the forms, the abstract forms that give reality to anything that we know in the world, because those things that we know participate in these abstract forms. So whatever's good, for example, is good because it participates in the form of goodness. And the form of goodness, as with all the other forms, is accessible only to our minds, to our intellects, to reason, not to our senses. What we see in this world are mere shadows. And so, for instance, he has that incredible allegory of the cave in the Republic. And he sees the point of life is to escape from the cave of shadows into the bright light of reality. But that bright light of reality requires that we somehow become detached from our senses and the body and see and understand only with our intellects. Now,
just a little
Aristotle... Sorry.
I was going to say, don't let me divert you from that train of thought, because I want to pick up there. But just as a very little aside, was it this separation that led to the Christian heresy of Gnosticism?
Not directly, but it certainly, Platonic dualism certainly contributed to that, and also seeped into Christianity both in terms of spirituality and also, in terms of the overall Christian view. And Platonism, and in the form of Neoplatonism, Middle Platonism, and Neoplatonism, had a huge influence on Christianity, huge influence on Saint Augustine. And it's only with Aquinas that the influence of Aristotle returns, and I'll explain how that happens.
Brilliant. That's obviously going to be something we'll return to in future podcasts because that's just so interesting because it's
Without a
still
doubt, without a
so
doubt.
relevant to what's happening today. But sorry, go back where you were before.
So Aristotle, first and foremost, I'd say, points to the significance of language, our language that structures the world. And he points to the world, precisely the world accessible to our senses, as the real world. So the real world for Plato is transcendent, beyond this world. For Aristotle, the real world is the world that we see, the world that we know, the world of objects, accessible to our senses. And so in Plato, what's required is a kind of leap of speculation, leading to arguments that seem at a great distance from common sense. Aristotle, on the other hand, says what we have to do to uncover truth is to analyze our everyday experience of the world, the world known to us by our senses and structured by our language. And so, of course, that's why the science, if you can call it that, of logic begins with Aristotle, the science of argument, as logic is. So you might say that Aristotle returns the world that we are familiar with to us and demarcates this as the real world. So this is a huge shift in emphasis from Plato. Now, Aristotle, of course, and his thinking is, like all philosophical trains of thought, affected by politics and social reality of the world at the time. And the simple fact of the matter is that Aristotle's work, though it was continued by people after him, he dies in 323, suffers, as all the even the Platonic strains of thought suffered, from an event that took place in 529. And that was the closure by the Emperor Justinian of the philosophical schools in Athens, both the Plato school, which had become heavily skeptical, and Aristotle's school. And this, of course, leads to a decline of interest. And of course, then after Justinian closes the schools in 529, Aristotle's work suffers a decline. Can I just say something about that date, 529? It's most interesting. A really, really wonderful coincidence. Justinian closes the philosophical schools of Athens in 529 because they're becoming too pagan. In the same year, Benedict founds his first monastery, Monte Cassino. So one great institution that influenced all our lives closes, and another institution that has influenced all our lives opened in the same year, 529.
That's really
Now,
fascinating. So just to interrupt, and again, don't lose your train of thought, but because when we get to Aquinas, didn't his parents actually want him to become a Benedictine?
Indeed, and
And
he lived at Monte Cassino,
yeah, and
where
he
there's the
rebelled
connection.
and became a Dominican.
That's right. That's
Hence,
right.
hence the title, Why, Oh, Why Aquinas? You know, I'm imagining myself as his mother saying, "Why, oh, why are you doing this?" Anyway, hopefully you'll shed light on this later, but.
So now, between the 7th and the 12th centuries, virtually all that was known of Aristotle in the West were some Latin translations by Boethius of Aristotle's logical works and some commentaries. Now, how do we recover Aristotle? Well, the Arabs, after the explosion of Islam in the 7th century, encountered the Greco-Roman world of the Byzantine East. And they, of course, still spoke Greek, and they were fascinated by Aristotle and his work, and much of it was translated into Arabic and Syriac. And some translations of Latin began to filter back into the West, some of them brought by the Crusaders, from the 12th century onwards. But by the beginning of the 13th century, that's Aquinas's century, Greek versions of Aristotle's texts became available again. And Thomas Aquinas was one of the few people who saw in this treasure trove of new work a real something that could be of great use to the Christian theologians and to the task of rendering Christian theology intelligible. Now, When we get to talk about Aquinas a little bit more, I want to show how or say how Aquinas was not alone, but he was certainly in a minority of people who thought this was a treasure trove. Many more conservative theologians thought it was an absolute nightmare, a dangerous source of heresy. Also, you must remember that after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West in the 5th century, the knowledge of Greek was practically lost in the West. And so, even if we'd had those Greek texts, we wouldn't have been able to read them. The cultural divide between East and West became so great that there was a cultural shift.
So when we talk about the knowledge of Greek, of course, we're not talking about Greek as it's spoken today. We're talking about classical Greek, aren't we? But when we talk about the Greek New Testament, was that the classical Greek that we're talking about here, or was it an even earlier form of Greek?
No, it's a later Greek. Now, the New Testament was written in what came to be called Koine Greek, common Greek, Koine. Now, how that comes about is this. We were talking about Philip of Macedon and Alexander the Great. Alexander's empire stretched across the whole world as far as India, Pakistan. Now, that what his empire, which is known as the Hellenistic Empire, the Hellenistic world, that made Greek into the current, the lingua franca of the whole empire. So the Romans would eventually take over all of that empire, but Greek was still the common language. So when the New Testament authors came to write the New Testament, the Gospels and the Epistles of Paul, their common language was Greek. Latin was the official language of the empire, but everybody spoke Greek. And so, that was the language of the empire, but that was the language we lost in the West, because, as you know, the Roman Empire first divided into East and West, and then when the Western Empire collapsed, we lost out on the language of the empire, which was centered then in Constantinople, in former Byzantium. So when these texts started filtering back from about 1150, the great job there was to get them translated, but also to have them purified of many Arabic and Islamic interpolations that were in the text. So this is one of the problems with these texts, that because they'd been used by a lot of Arab commentators, Averroes in particular, they had a lot of marginalia and interpolations that seemed to suggest ideas, and many of Aristotle's ideas also, that were clean contrary to a Christian worldview. But Aquinas could see that at the heart of these texts was something incredibly valuable, incredibly interesting, and of course, incredibly controversial. So now we're at the stage where Aquinas is the leading Aristotelian, along with one of his great teachers, Albert the Great, another Dominican. So shall we, if we stop there, we can perhaps then talk about Aquinas himself.
Aquinas was from quite a privileged background, wasn't he?
Indeed, he was from an aristocratic background. Aquinas was born in Rocca Secca, in the territory between Rome and Naples, and on the borders of the Empire and the Papal States. There was always tension between the Emperor, especially in that time, Frederick II, and the Popes. He came from an aristocratic family. And very early on, as was the custom, he was placed in the monastery of Monte Cassino, and obviously the hope as an oblate, and the hope, of course, was that he would eventually become the abbot of Monte Cassino.
I mean, saying
Because,
very early on, but he was about five, wasn't he, or something?
yeah, they'd put in as children, you see.
Yes.
It was hoped he'd become the abbot. Remember, these places were hugely wealthy, but also great centres of learning, and also very aristocratic. Anyway, the reason he didn't stay at Monte Cassino was because war broke out between the Pope and the Emperor, he had to be taken away from Monte Cassino because it was on the front line of the battles. Where did he go? He went to Naples, and in Naples was the only secular university in the world at that time. Remember, the 13th century is the century of when the universities were first founded, but this was the only secular university because it was founded not by the popes, who founded all the other universities, but by the emperor. and it was a kind of civil service college. However, because Naples at the time was a great crossroads of cultures, east and west, remember that whole part of Italy further south and into Sicily was known as Magna Graeca. That was a great melting pot of cultures, and it was at the University of Naples that Aquinas first encountered Aristotle. The texts were being translated there. In due course, Aquinas decided to join the Dominicans. Remember, the Dominicans and the Franciscans were new religious orders, so-called mendicant orders. They were an innovation of the 13th century, quite different from the monks in many critical regards. His family were very much against this, and they kidnapped him to try and stop him joining. But eventually, they did release him, and he joined the order and was eventually sent north to join Albert the Great in Cologne, where he was teaching. And Albert the Great himself was a great Aristotelian. That was when it was from that point that his academic career began. His very first teaching post was in Paris, which was the greatest of all the universities, the medieval universities, and the greatest theology faculty. He started teaching on the very same day as the great Franciscan theologian, Saint Bonaventure. They knew each other. And the day they both started teaching, university masters had gone on strike in complaint against the mendicant orders. I won't go into the details. So both St. Thomas and St. Bonaventure started their teaching careers as scabs during a strike. Aquinas is, where to start? Aquinas's contribution is without equal. He's hailed by theologians and philosophers alike as one of the greatest minds of the Middle Ages. His thought is capacious, his interest is vast, but he is fundamentally a Christian intellectual who is intent on rendering Christianity intelligible in this new, exciting, rapidly changing world of the 13th century, a century in many, many ways very similar to our own.
So, before we get in onto how he did this, just quickly tell me why he matters so much today, and what did we care about Aquinas now, and we want to know why he did this and how he did this and how he got going and what happened, because
Yeah.
he's still so relevant to today.
I mean, there's a lot to be said about how he interest in him waxed and waned. Let me just say this as a little bit of an interesting detail. He was condemned. Some of his thinking was condemned after his death, and before he was canonized. So he was an avant-garde thinker in his own age. Taught a lot of things that were very controversial, but he was a very clear-minded thinker. Now, one of his names is the Common Doctor of the Church, and so the problem with all that was that his work came kind of a standard theological text, and when that happens, that's often quite dangerous because people excerpted much of his work, and the historical context was lost, and to some extent, people weren't really reading Aquinas; they were reading bits of Aquinas. Now, when the Second Vatican Council came along, he fell from view slightly because people felt liberated from having to read these manuals of theology. But in a funny kind of way, and certainly a beneficial way, when he was no longer the kind of official theologian of the church, it was possible for people to read the full texts more freely, and a lot of people who weren't within the Catholic Church became more and more interested again in Aquinas. And there has been a positive renaissance in the last 50 years in interest in Aquinas. Now, why is that interest so acute? I think the point about Aquinas is he's a man of such remarkable open-mindedness. What practically marks him out from most of his contemporaries in the 13th century was that he was interested comprehensively and in absolutely enormous breadth of topics, like his veritably polymath teacher, Albert the Great. He's endlessly curious about practically everything. Wisdom, he thinks, is to be welcomed from wherever you can find it. And in a way, he epitomizes that spirit of openness, which is at the core of Christian humanism, which has oftentimes been overlaid by a more narrow approach, but which is not at all what Christianity is about. Now, he was, of course, a teacher all his life, a teacher of theology. He didn't see a distinction between theology and philosophy the way we did. He thought you couldn't do theology without philosophy. He saw no contradiction whatsoever between reason and revelation. For him, logic and mystery were interrelated. The more you push reason, the closer you come to mystery, but you must be, as it were, intent on using your reason to its absolute limit.
So that's great, Auburn. So can I ask you, if it's not jumping around too much, to go back then to when he was starting out and what happened as he began to read these texts of Aristotle and suddenly was launched upon the world and relating those ancient Greek teachings to that world he was living in.
Well, of course, I'm now talking in very, very broad brush strokes. His academic career is launched from Paris. He rapidly becomes a teacher in demand. He's used by his order in various parts of various teaching centres of the order. He becomes valued by kings and all kinds of other people for his advice. He's a man in great demand, and consequently, he spends a lot of time travelling from Naples to Cologne to Paris to Oviedo, etc. He's on the road a lot. But still, even with the limitations of the time, no electricity, no travel facilities that make life easier, he manages to turn out some such incredible output. He's much of his writing reflects his teaching, and so he becomes a master of the teaching vehicle of high scholasticism, the disputation. This is a the disputatio was the principal teaching tool, and this was a way of opening something up to serious and extensive questions. I mean, a disputation, which involved students and teaching staff in the universities. He was a past master at disputations, and his last and unfinished greatest work, the Summa Theologiae, is written out in the form of a disputation,
So
and it's
he wasn't doing all this on a laptop, was he? What was he writing with and on, and in what language?
he used to he does it all in Latin. He dictates to sometimes two secretaries at the same time. His own handwriting was famously illegible. It was known even in the 13th century as the littera illegibilis. And we've got some examples of it. So he's writing, dictating. Remember, books are in very short supply. I mean, there aren't books, they're texts, manuscripts. So he's working against all the odds, and yet he's producing not just vast amounts of work, but work of such high quality. Now, one of the things that grabs his interest from the very beginning are the texts of Aristotle, and practically throughout his life, even almost to the end of his life, he's writing line by line commentaries on Aristotle. What he sees in Aristotle, and what others saw and were terrified by it, was a metaphysic, a worldview, which owed nothing to Christianity, but which was so in tune, he thought, with the essential insights of Christianity. And if you were to ask one point that undergirds everything he has to say in all his writing, it's this: the goodness of creation. Because what exists is created by God. So the two poles of all his thinking are God, the source of everything, and creation, the effect of God's creative will. And everything else in his work is considered in relation to God, or as the creation of God. When G.K. Chesterton wrote a wonderful little book on St. Thomas, he calls him Thomas Aquinas a creatore, Thomas Aquinas of the Creator. And that is the essential insight, the goodness of creation. He sees in Aristotle one who affirms, unlike Plato, the reality of the natural world, Aristotle, as you know, was fascinated by the natural world. He was a great observer of nature. He spent 2 whole years on the island of Lesbos cataloguing marine life. But Aristotle also offers, as it were, an overview of the world, human agency within the world, and particularly, and this is particularly important for Aquinas, he offers a view of what we human beings are, what we're for, and how we strive to achieve fulfillment, how we strive to achieve human flourishing. And in one of his great works, the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle's, again, Aquinas writes a commentary on that. And that becomes something, the ethical work of Aristotle, the ethical outlook, it becomes for Aquinas, this is slightly controversial what I'm about to say, some people would disagree with this, but certainly Aquinas absorbs all of that and builds on that, obviously with hugely different emphases and different influences that were not available to Aristotle. But essentially, people in the past used to talk about Aquinas baptizing Aristotle. That's an overstatement. Aquinas is a hugely innovative synthesizer. There's Plato, Platonism, Aristotle, Aristotelianism, Augustine and Augustinianism. He's in dialogue, this is Aquinas, with Jewish philosophers, with Arabic philosophers, all kinds of people. And, this is a real tribute to his open-mindedness, that he is unafraid of any truth and completely ready to accept whatever truth you could uncover from whatever source. Consider, he says, not by who utters the truth, but whether it be true or not. So Aristotle is one of his great sources of inspiration, but also he thinks he finds in Aristotle great truths and hugely useful ways of rendering Christian faith and the Christian insights of the gospel into intelligible form for his own generation.
But don't some people criticize Aquinas? For example, Bertrand Russell, for putting revelation. So Aquinas obviously was a Christian, and he believed in the revelation and the gospel. Whereas people like Bertrand Russell thought that a true philosopher, a true thinker, should be open to everything, even the possibility of atheism being true, and that by having a faith as his starting point, Aquinas was not the great man that so many hold him to be.
Well, Bertrand Russell is not a very good authority on anything philosophical, certainly not on the history of philosophy. But Bertrand Russell is himself, all he has to say is premised on the prejudice that faith and reason are already polar opposites and incompatible, mutually exclusive. This is simply a tendentious caricature of the relationship between thinking and believing, between reasoning and faith. The simple fact of the matter is that Aquinas, there's no such thing as pure reason, there's no such thing as pure faith, by which I don't mean pure in the sense of unalloyed. Reason and faith are interconnected. Reasoning without faith and believing without reason are both forms of fundamentalism. And I think that Bertrand Russell himself was a fundamentalist in that sense, a kind of rationalist fundamentalist. So, I mean, this is a topic we could spend a whole session discussing, and perhaps we should at some stage. But I don't think that anybody would really lend credence to that view of Aquinas now. Aquinas, I mean, remember, Aquinas' famous five ways, which people take to be proofs of God's existence, are missed on, he says, if we have reason, what do we need revelation for? He poses the question himself. If we've got reason, isn't that enough? And one of the ways he approaches the demonstrations of God's existence, but not just his existence, but what the notion of God means, what sense it makes, if you have reason, what else do you need? So he's quite capable and quite ready and willing to start off from that kind of position. In other words, he doesn't take it for granted. He wants to show how it makes sense, why it's a coherent position to hold.
Well, certainly the five ways are something I would very much like to look at. And as you say, a whole session could be devoted to that. And
Yeah,
also, I'd quite like
definitely.
to look at in more detail at what Aquinas wrote about truth,
Yeah.
because he had some really interesting things to say about that. We're running at, coming close to the end now, but I'd just like you to say, if possible, a little bit about the relevance of Aquinas to us, to the secular world today. How can we learn from Aquinas in dealing with some of the scary things that are happening around us today, especially with regards to relativism,
Yeah.
and to go back to the time of Plato, when the sophists, as you said in your recent lecture in America, sophists made a financial killing on the back of relativism. And isn't that so much what we're seeing now in the markets and the ruthless exploitation of
Yes.
people by those with their hands on the levers of monetary power? I believe that there is methods to be found in the teachings of people like Aquinas to help ordinary people like you and me counter some of this when it manifests in our own lives, but also to help others counter it too when it manifests in their
Yes.
lives. So I just wondered if you could, give some ideas of how we might do this.
Yes, I mean, perhaps we can devote some time to the more time to this, because I think there are things to be said here about broad patterns of thinking that are obvious in Aquinas and would certainly benefit us in our time. I mean, one of the things I think I would say is this. I mean, one of his main contributions that is particularly relevant to the modern world is his ethical outlook, very much incorporating Aquinas, Aristotle, but expanding in many important ways. And we can devote some time to that at a later stage. But I think that one of the things about Aquinas is, and this would be the kind of thing that would be the antidote to any prejudice that Bertrand Russell might bring to bear. Aquinas has no time for simplistic reductionism. He is determinedly against any false dichotomies. Aquinas's thinking is very much both and, not either or. So the idea of science or religion doesn't make sense to him. It's science and religion. The idea of reason or faith, again, nonsense. It's reason and faith. The idea of freedom and obedience, no, freedom and obedience belong together. So the both and either or is the hallmark of his thinking, his comprehensive, capacious thinking. I think that he has he says quite literally, consider not by whom a truth is spoken, but only whether it be true or not. There's a kind of honesty, but there's an honesty also about the limitations of reason. So, for instance, he's absolutely, there's a kind of intellectual modesty about him. There's a modesty that enables him to say, for instance, that we cannot know what God is, that we are united to God most perfectly when we are united to him as completely unknown. And so there is this huge respect for the mystery of existence, for the mysteries as much as the things we can explain. And it's indeed rather in the way Wittgenstein talks about what the mystery is that the world is, not how it is. And so that reverence for the creation, reverence not just in a kind of, not for nature as such, but for the created world and the mystery that creation itself, as well as God, confronts us with. So I think that intellectual modesty is a tremendous lesson. But I'd say, above all, I think it's his moral outlook.
Thank you very much, Alban, for being with us. And I can't wait to talk to you again because there's so much there. Listen out for our next episode next week. And thank you for joining us.